Good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name's Karen Ciccone, and I'm the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals and Journals. And it's a real pleasure to welcome you all here to the New York Public Library tonight for Periodically Speaking, focus on poetry. Some of you may know we're focusing Periodically Speaking for the next for the rest of the spring and the fall, and we're going to be focusing on poetry and poetry journals. But our mission, Periodically Speaking's mission, is the same, which is to provide a venue for emerging writers, for us to have a chance to highlight the great magazines that are held in the New York Public Library's collection. And they're great, and we have great poetry journals. We also have wonderful poetry books, historically and contemporary. So I really encourage you to discover what we have here by going to the website and coming in and visiting us. I want to give a big thanks to Tasha Sorensen for doing such a fabulous job for curating Periodically Speaking. And thanks to everyone at CLMP. So enjoy the evening, and now I'm going to introduce Jeffrey Leppendorf, who's the executive director of CLMP, who will introduce the program tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Always thrilled to be back in this magnificent room. And delighted to be working with the New York Public Library. Do come here and discover some of the great literary magazines that are out there, and then please subscribe to them. It's really the only way they can remain periodicals, continually putting out what they do. So it's very important to subscribe and support them. A couple of quick thank yous. We're able to provide these free programs because of the generosity of a few wonderful foundations, namely the Axe Houghton Foundation, New York Department of Cultural Affairs, National Endowment for the Arts, and New York State Council for the Arts, a state agency. So thank you to them for funding this program for quite some time. We hope we'll do it forever. We actually could never present to you all of the literary magazines in America. As I stand here right now, there are probably 1,000, and next week there probably will be 1,002. So there are new ones all the time. And tonight I'm very happy to introduce to you, if you don't know it already, one of our favorites. Literary magazines serve a number of important roles, and one of the most important, even more so today, is of providing reviews. And the review is one of the unsung heroes of literature. And so tonight I'm very happy to present, for us to be featuring tonight, Rain Taxi Review of Books, which focuses entirely on reviews as well as other features, but has really made it its mission, the art of the review. And today we're going to focus on what it means to be a poet reviewer, which is an interesting phenomenon. We'll hear all about it. So now, without further ado, I should say, before I introduce tonight's moderator and editor of Rain Taxi, in front of you there are tiny pencils, which you may take home as your keepsake of tonight. Before you do so, though, please take a moment to fill out the survey. Believe it or not, this is what the foundations who give us money get back. So if you would like to see more free programs like this, please just take a moment to fill out the little survey. It's not to rub our egos, it's to rub the egos of the foundations, which is really important, and they deserve to have their egos rubbed, so please do that for them and for us. And now, without further ado, I'm very happy to introduce Eric Lorber, a fine poet in his own right, who is also here as editor of Rain Taxi Review Books. Eric, take away.
Thank you very much. It's such a great pleasure to be here. I've been telling authors and publishers that I've been visiting with over the past few days that I have not been in this building since I was a little boy, so it's quite a treat to come back under these auspices. I just wanted to say a few words about Rain Taxi before introducing our distinguished panelists. In case you don't know it, the library has kindly put out some of its holdings in the back, and I encourage you to look at them. As Jeffrey said, we are a magazine totally devoted to the art of criticism through reviews of new material, of classic material, of out-of-print material. And our mission is really to expand the audience for all kinds of innovative writing. Poetry plays a very big part in that, but we also cover innovative fiction and graphic novels. One publisher says we were the first national periodical to cover graphic novels regularly. So we're very dedicated to expanding the minds of all kinds of readers. So even if you are a diehard reader, I challenge you to read an issue and not find one or two books that you have not heard about that would be worth your attention. That seems to be, in fact, one of the roles that we're filling in today's changing climate of criticism, which I think we're going to talk about tonight. I wanted to briefly situate us by quoting from a speech that the poet John Ashbery gave at the National Book Critics Circle last year when the National Book Critics Circle celebrated its 35th anniversary. And Ashbery, as some of you may know, was the recipient of their first award in poetry 36 years ago now, and was asked to speak to the circle about the changing climate. And I think he said a very provocative thing during his remarks to the critics. And so here I'm quoting, "At the risk of sounding ungrateful, I have to say that poetry gets a lot less space in general interest publications than it used to. There seemed to be a moment in the 80s when it dawned on mainstream media that they didn't have to review it, like an adolescent who suddenly discovers he no longer has to choke down his veggies. But this event has been accompanied by a rise in specialized journals like the terrific Rain Taxi in Minneapolis, an American Book Review, and others. It seems to have resulted somehow in an increased readership for poetry. Those of us who want it know where to look and how to communicate our knowledge to others like us." So I found that a really curious remark, and I've been mulling it over in my mind. It's, as most of Ashbery's remarks, it's actually kind of dense and complicated and packed with its own argument with itself. So I offer that just as a prelude, but as the real prelude, what I'd really like to do is have each of our poets read some of their own work tonight and situate us in the creative mind as well before we turn to their critical practice. So I think we'll just go right down the line here. Today we have Jordan Davis, Craig Morgan Teicher, and Maureen McLean. If we can, Jordan, do you mind going first here? Jordan is a wonderful poet with one of my favorite books of the last decade, Million Poems Journal. And I also know his criticism regularly from his work on the website Constant Critic, which I highly recommend. But I know that he has also written for publications across the country, such as The Nation and the TLS and so forth. So here is Jordan.
Thanks, Eric. I'm going to try to sit and read. We'll see how that goes. Thanks for coming out. Thanks, Eric. Adults don't tell other adults what to do. Adults don't tell other adults what to do. This proposition strikes me as so important I ought to preach it in the subway corridor. Hello, hear the good news and the thank you. Adults don't tell other adults what to do. Because I am 4 years old, I add no what else, but to go on would dilute this singular message, distract from its manifold consequence. Adults don't tell other adults what to do. We do, however, pay attention to each other and speak freely of what we're feeling. A person covered in shit or blood needs help. An adult who harms her or himself repeatedly, looking away, is still paying attention, getting an MSW, praying, voting, going to the bar. Speak freely to me of what you're feeling. I know and respect you and am aware. Adults don't tell other adults what to do. Mostly read The Luna Moth. The savor of mango is unlike toothsome papay. My son takes my hand and brings me into the classroom. Fluffy is absent and unremarked upon, and in his place, two butterflies use tentatively in a sentence. One, he explains, is a boy, and the other one lays the eggs. I counted the dots, is a girl. Why do boys not feed babies? He reaches to pull his shirt open, and I ask him, "Did you ever see a baby eat broccoli, a ham sandwich?" Someday I will tell him food is an unpleasant subject for poems, but today I am concerned with biology. "I'm a science kid," he says on the platform. Where do you hear that? I know where the one about men nursing came from. Seeing myself tell that story, I feel like California's poisoned groundwater and remember how much work it is to be real. Someone told you men can give milk, but men don't. What about moms and dads who don't have children? Those are called men and women. He says, "Oh," a lot. It's immediate, and it lags into the next moment and is quiet, what the teachers call a zone of proximal delay. Without this apparent lull, there's only brilliance and potential. With it, I get to keep a faith in the unguessable next. More baby poems. Why not? He's a good foil. Narragansett. That's a terrible thing for a child to be. He's a good kid. The Narragansett. The complete sentence narrates a satisfying process. It closes and opens like a clam. I take a knife to the sentence and start my evening at the raw bar. It is hard work, and the sentences would prefer to be in the ocean. I would rather be a patron of this establishment. Someone over my shoulder would rather know I am going to continue to put up with his stuff. It is not a wide receiver, his stuff. It is his development, which is gradual. It involves testing me. Sometimes these tests take the form of imperatives. Drive onto the boat. The boat would rather be en route to Maine. It is an ambitious ferry. My knife wishes to whittle patterns into the enormous picnic table. Art does not narrate. Text messages. A wave of love for you just knocked me off my chair. I will love you and love you. I will reach out my hand to you in the noise of car horns and merengue and pull you close by the waist. I will call you my museum of everything always. I will call you MDMA. I love you, ecstatic, exalted, sublime. I wish you were here. There's an enormous cloud sitting off in the distance. It's a beautiful walk from there to my place. I'm buzzing, but the buzzer may not be working. There's a raccoon rearing on his hind legs, twitching its nose from behind a short fence. Let me stew you some tomatoes. As long as I keep moving, the overtones don't jackhammer my skull. I'm waiting for something very, very good. My phone is like, what? I'm a phone. The moon is moving. High above the subway and the airplanes, it starts above the Bronx and finishes in New Jersey. It goes behind the rooftops as the bus goes down the avenue. It moves over the courtyard and shines on you as you dream of flying. It starts out pink and ends up yellow. Every night there is less or more of it until it's round like a clock, as when you turn to look, the second hand seems to stop, just so the moon. The moon is moving. I'm wearing a suit because I work at a job. Ira will not be attending the meeting. When working on a small scale, he is practicing a gesture. So much of life is practicing gestures. So much of living is evaluating those around you for signs of damage. Now it is night. Morning's a blink away. Sleep is sometimes thought of as an avalanche of repair gnomes that attends your pit stop. Would that we were sleeping now. Viable alternatives will be reviled until the point of no return is passed. The only reasonable course of action is to look for sizable flotsam, redo the resume, learn a martial art. The cardinal sin of poetry readings is to say two more. And I never come into a major public building without committing a cardinal sin. It's a terrible joke, and I appreciate you're not laughing at it. This is a poem for the Irish comedian Dylan Moran. If he ever comes here, just sell whatever you have on your person and go buy a ticket. For Dylan Moran, did you ever see the show Black Books? He was Bernard Black. Anyway, for Dylan Moran or after him, the instructive disappearing act of a hallway of misanthrope nematodes. You see enough basic cable, you get the sense someone is following your great friend with a balloon of morons. And here's the amazing thing. All our simpatico guest starring can't pressure a simple hello into that tube top. The idea itself. Men in top hats chasing cash on the breeze. To know the truth and watch the world ignore it. Fight it, in fact, with all its paper. The gold doors of the vault protect some old comedy. The desk has nothing on it. Well, a Guinness. A good likeness for an origin myth. I put the cake up to my chin, filled with love for my countrymen. The lines of the factory guide the plane into a mirrored quilted space, lined with vases of roses, the very limousine of heaven. Individuals are hard to find, even with the armbands. I love the French for thinking so, and pity their bad luck. We live among childish rubrics and a pizza oven, vacant so long squirrels have claimed it in the name of GORP. Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan. Next up, we'll have Craig Morgan Teicher. Craig plays an invaluable role in the publishing community as a prime defender of poetry and independent publishing at Publishers Weekly. But he is also a terrific poet. His first book, Brenda is in the Room, came out, I think, in 2007. And he has a new book just out this week called Cradle Book, except if you look at the description of the book on the back, it says, even the subtitle, Stories and Fables, although I predict some will call this prose poetry. So maybe that's something we can talk about later. Craig.
It's all lies. All of it. Well, no, it's not. I mean, that's all true, but other stuff. So this is this book of fables. I don't know. I always wanted to be a fiction writer, but it takes much too long, I think. So I thought if I could have fiction that was only a page long, then I could do it. So I'll read you a few of those. This is called The Groaning Cows. And so they're fables, and so it's a lot of, like, bad things happening to animals. And, of course, that represents bad things happening to people. But, I mean, pretty much everything that happens in here is bad. So here it is. The Groaning Cows. One night, as if responding to some invisible signal, all the cows began groaning. They groaned and groaned all the next day and did not stop at nightfall. This went on for days and days. No one could sleep. The children were becoming more and more afraid. Nearly driven mad, everyone in town gathered in the meeting hall. Were the cows sick? Was it a warning? Of what? What should they do? No one could agree. Someone suggested that perhaps there was something wrong with the grass, and the cows were groaning because their stomachs ached. But this did not seem likely, as the other animals ate the same grass, and none of them were groaning. Someone else wondered whether the cows had finally tired of their servitude. Perhaps their groaning was a cry for freedom. But no one else was willing to believe that cows had such ideas. No one could think of a good explanation, and no one could think what to do, so they agreed to meet again in 1 week's time. Still, the cows continued to groan, night and day, while the farmers milked them, while they were being led out to pasture, when it was dark outside and they should have slept. Their voices never tired of groaning. After a week had passed, the town gathered again, and the mayor said that something must be done. He determined that all the cows in town must be slaughtered. Then he would go to the next town and buy more cows with the money set aside for the harvest festival, which they would have to do without this year. Since no one could think of a better idea, the people of the town agreed. That night, all the men met in the square. They brought with them every tool of violence they had, scythes and clubs, knives and picks and rakes, so no one would be without a weapon. Then, holding torches, the mob made its way to the first farm. They would all kill the cows together. As they reached the place where the groaning cows were standing, the cows seemed to take no notice of their approach, despite the glint of the torches on the blades the men carried. In truth, the men were nervous, still unsure whether they were truly taking the best course, but the mayor was among them, and he urged them on. They raised their weapons and prepared to strike. Just then, a girl ran into the path and stood between the men and the cows. She was the weaver's daughter, a quiet girl who kept rabbits and liked to make up songs. "Stop," she cried. "You must not kill these cows, or else terrible luck will befall us all." Then she put her hand on the soft muzzle of the nearest cow. To her surprise, and to the surprise of everyone there, as she touched it, the cow stopped groaning. Soon, all of the cows were quiet, and precious silence filled the night. Everyone went home and slept for what seemed like the first time in their lives. The next night, just as the sun finally set, all the pigs began groaning, as if responding to some invisible signal. They groaned and groaned and would not stop. The poor weaver's daughter. She knew then, when she heard the groaning, that her life would never be her own. It would belong to the pigs and the cows, to the goats and the ducks, to the hens and the rabbits. Most of all, it would belong to the men, whom she knew would never let her be.
Okay, bad things. Lots of them. So this is called The Virtues of Birds. Two birds came upon a crust of bread lying on the path through the woods. "Please, after you," said the first bird. "No, you saw the crust before I did. You eat first," replied the second. "No, I didn't. I was distracted for a moment by a beautiful song. I thought it was a she-bird singing. I thought she might be calling me. But I could not see her amongst the trees. Then I saw you leaning over this crust of bread. So, in fact, you must have seen it first." "I too heard singing, but I thought it came from over there, by the stream. I was about to walk that way when I noticed you on the path, guarding the crust." "No, I was never guarding it. As soon as I saw you with the crust, I thought, 'There's plenty here for two birds. We shall both have a feast, if only you will not keep all for yourself.' How could you think I would eat it all? I'm only one bird, with room in my stomach for only half a crust of bread. When I saw you with your crust, I hoped you would feel the same way." The sun was starting to set. The woods began to darken. The birds could hear a frightful clamor rising in the distance, grunting and shuffling in the leaves. "Please," said the first bird, who sensed the darkness was welling around him, "eat now. We haven't much time." "Yes, it is growing dark," said the second bird, who remembered what he had been told about the woods. "But I would be impolite if I ate first, and politeness is foremost among the virtues of birds." "Certainly it is," rejoined the first. "A bird hates to clutter a path on which someone is walking, so he skips away. But for a bird, perhaps caution is a greater virtue. How do I know the crust is not laced with some poison to which you are a party? How can I be sure you do not wish me dead so you can scavenge my nest for sticks?" "Persistence is also a virtue of birds," replied the second coarsely. "How do I know that you do not hope to scare me off with your theories of poison and have the whole crust for yourself? And how do I know you've not struck a bargain with a wolf or some other desperate animal? He may be waiting behind that rock right now, ready to swallow me whole." "Go see for yourself. No wolf waits there," said the first bird. "Ha! And leave you to make off with the unprotected crust? I think not," said the second. By now it had grown terribly dark, and the creatures who haunt the woods were awake. The clamor closed in like a gloved hand slowly tightening its fingers. And this is about somebody who, it's called Raised by Wolves, and it's about somebody who was not raised by wolves. Raised by wolves. He could have been, though he was not. He'd never even seen a wolf. He had lived with his father and mother in a big white house with a bay window. But had he been left in the woods, though they would never have left him anywhere and never went in the woods, wolves could have found him, and instead of thrashing him about until he was only something for them to eat, they could have taken him in as one of their own, though of course that is not what happened. Though had it happened, he would never have had to suffer his father's senseless midnight rages, nor his anxious morning silence as though the day had been haunting him all night long, nor his mother's cowed protectiveness, all of which he did suffer, swaddled in a silence of his own. but he could have learned to detect the unfamiliar scent of an intruder in the woods or the well-known odor of an enemy. He could have known how to distinguish predator from prey by the rustling of the leaves, though what would prey on a wolf? Of course, he never had to answer that question, for he was safe in his house, where even the walls cast shadows and the floors groaned to mark the slow passing of his long childhood years. But he could have run with the pack. Perhaps he could have even led it, were he able to tame his fellow wolves by filling their hearts with fear, which they deeply love, for fear brings order to their wild lives, tells them where to go and what to do. For he did know that those whom he most feared and those whom he tried to make most afraid were the ones whose love he most deeply needed.
And then I'm going to do my two more warning now. One of them is very short, and the other one is pretty short. This is called The Dragon.
In fact, real dragons were quite small. They did breathe fire, but only enough to be mistaken for a firefly on a very dark night. They were as harmless as fireflies, though that did not stop anyone from killing them.
And this takes on a big subject. It's called time.
I was once a bigger stone, and I'll be smaller stones soon enough, says the stone. I grow only in number, never in size. Time will never make a mountain, but it made each grain of sand. You will never find my source nor my final drop, says the river. I'm always on my way between. Time flows like a finger that never narrows to point, yet never widens to join a hand. What you hear has always just ended or is always about to begin, says the song. Music is what is between silence and sound. Time is the work of a band. I am what the sun shows, but what you won't show the sun, says the shadow. Yet I'm gone at night. Time is what takes away whatever you understand. I stop where the sky begins, yet never touch what I grow to reach, says the tree. I am a living wish. Time ends each sentence with and. Thanks.
Thank you, Craig. And finally, we'll hear from Maureen McLean. I first encountered Maureen's writing as reviews in newspapers such as the New York Times and the Washington Post. We occasionally get these things out in Minneapolis. And in about 6 years ago, she won the Nona Balakian Award for excellence in book reviewing, well deserved. And since that time, she has published two volumes of her own poetry in fairly quick succession, Same Life and this new one, World Enough, which I think today you won't be able to find in a bookstore, but very, very soon, I suspect in the next week or so. So, Maureen McLean.
I'm going to stand. Just to thank Eric for inviting me to join this wonderful panel and the New York Public Library and CLMP for sponsoring this. So I just would start with a poem from the new book, World Enough, called Roundel. The sea's in the dolphin, the sun's in the rose, the stars in my lungs are breathing, the clouds in the rain, the sea's in. Time to unlink every chain linking doing to what's been done to doing again and again. The seas in the dolphin, the suns in the rose are the stars my lungs breathe in, the clouds in the rain, the season. Thinking about the remit of this panel, Poetry and Criticism, I was trying to think of or land on a few poems that tacked between song and thought, lyric and critique, and moments of reading at times. So, because I think all of us are doing this in several different idioms. So, an excerpt from a longer poem called Saratoga August. Rain, rain, and the trees engulfed. I'm tired of reading Russians, their suffering souls, their tribulations, excavating a dank depth. They surely have a word for that fatal Russian soul. Easy to see how a blast of speed called light might clear the air, the heavy hooves of the horses now stopped from racing a mile away. Swaying cedars, a light wind, and a low canopy of clouds belie the summer you recall from the calendar. If I say spring and you think September, you might be from Australia. If I say love and you think sex, you are not Thomas Aquinas. I am not worried about my brain today or TV or the latest war in the Caucasus. Creepy philosophers, isolados in huts, articulate a theory of care. I close my eyes and the world disappears. You open yours and the clouds rearrange themselves, shuffling the birds. Wow, the latest hysteria, our version of a rain dance. Oh, it's coming, friends, the endless rains we longed for, danced for, and the deserts we thought we knew will be thickly forested in the blink of some creature's eye. Geography's back, and new maps, and the dolphins displaced by sick tones. How anyone thought music meaningless or universal. How anyone thought alone would have everything to do with it. The wind picks up a cloud shift's sense, transferring whatever, the helplessly metaphorical wind. If I say thunder and you answer lightning, were you already so near I could touch you? And thunder and you turn off your computer? Were you listening to me or the weather report? I'm not getting any younger, says the thunder to the sky. I'm not moving any farther, says the cloud that won't pass by. Three down with rumored Lyme, but antibiotics are saving us all from the worst for the moment. If I say we charmed the sun with spells of guava rum and grapefruit punch, you should believe it was a swell pool party last night. This morning's benediction of eggs, sunny side up, proving it so. If not everyone came, well, that's okay. We can feel it waning, the days, the months, the season, our casually shared lives. Intimations of immortality are all very well, if all shall be well, but intimations of nothing are more useful if you have a residual Calvinist soul. You don't need to be a voluptuary of death or dream or your dark heart to want to know how its shaping hand is shaping every hour. Heedless, heedful, what's needful is what we sometimes ask when surfacing from a freestyle lap, the pool bottoming the abyss. Oh, reason not the need, but can one help but reason when it seizes the works and days of our thinking? You'd never know who was good in bed, at poker, at pool, unless you put yourself through it. The sea calls for drowning, the pool for floating, some days for lounging. If I say cypress and you think morning, you might read Latin. If I say hemlock and you think trees and Socrates, you will not be surprised by our priceless ignorance. Let us devote a week to nothing that will not give pleasure. Let us devote a life to what's not to like in this world, if what's not to like in this world is moving us into the next. And finally, sun in the morning, proving morning, after all, the time of sunrises. See, you've already forgotten the rain and the cumulus courting the sun it won't block. Forgotten the pull of the moon just past full is affecting the waves. The song of the cardinal flaring the hemlock so long ago rang out so long ago, nothing belongs to that rain gone so long you've almost forgotten how long ago rained down the rain. And then a couple of briefer poems. Terrible things are happening. Terrible things are happening in Russian novels. Just yesterday, I heard in the cafe of two peasants, long friends, one in sudden possession of a watch hanging from a gold chain, which so disturbed his compadre, he stole upon the other unsuspecting, prayed to God, and slit his throat, fleeing with the watch. And that's not the worst of it. Just yesterday, my love and I, too, had not exactly a fight, but a reckoning, perhaps, or no, a conversation which opened the ocean of grief. And now she is in another city, perhaps crying, and not because of Russian novels. A poem, it's not that. And there are three acronyms in this poem, BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the right-wing Hindu Nationalist Party, GDP, Gross Domestic Product, ATV, All-Terrain Vehicle. It's not that. It's not that I'm opposed to poison in my lips or pig in my soap. It's not that I'm opposed. It's not that I'm opposed to plastic bottles that won't decompose, to malodorous phosphorus flows. It's not that I'm opposed to what you propose, surgery on your imperfect nose, favelas blasted with hoses. It's not that I'm opposed to opposing the opposite of anonymous neighbors, the nosy stargazers who discover new celebrity planets about to crash into your car. It's not that I'm opposed that we drive when it's not very far to walk or bike. Not opposed you're opposed to the subway, the stink of the general, train 4, 5, or 6. Not opposed to the sex on Craigslist, to your pet's special tricks, to the organized slaughter of cows by the tenderest machines. Not opposed to your dreams, to their screams, to our hopes. Not opposed to the hordes with their ropes, knives, and bombs set in desolate streets, slums, and thrumming towns. Not opposed to your proms and baptisms, to ongoing Christian schisms. Most unopposed to fierce Muslims, Jews, Baha'is, and Hindus posed in poses temples now oppose, the petty bourgeois, the Kama Sutra to Ooh La La for the petty bourgeois members of the BJP. Not opposed to a big GDP, to a loud ATV. Not opposed to anything I can see, hear, or touch, to enough or too much. It's not that I'm opposed to whatever I should propose opposing, knowing is thinning in the species extra inning, on a world slow spinning, on an axis slightly tilting into folly. So is it folly to suppose you could oppose proposing something to oppose? And last, every day a shiny, bright new day. It's good not to drink. It's good not to piss in the sink. And it's good not to think. The clarion ring of a glass clinking with ice, good to hear it fade into a past you can't sing. Your dumb blues is over. Admit it was always borrowed. You paid no dues. You did no time but the time spent sodden. What you thought, I think. Your higher powers drunk. God's the biggest Elkie in the sky. The clouds are whiskey sours passing by. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Maureen. So I guess we'll have a little conversation here. I promise to stop any fist fights, or not. But you know, I wanted to start off, and Maureen alluded to one possible direction for this when you talked about poetry that tacks between song and thought. But I thought I'd ask each of you whether working on critical writing and reviewing affects the work you do, the as a poet, the creative work you do. And yeah, any?
I went first and don't know my answer. I don't know. I mean, you know, I feel like for me, I can't write without actively reading at the same time. I mean, nothing comes unless something I'm reading something. And I feel like reviewing became a kind of adult excuse to read a lot. And so
In a way, that's, I think, at base why I do it. But I also think it's fun to try and find ways of combining the kind of discursive and often, you know, sort of flirt with the kind of boring and or not boring, but, you know, where you have to make something exciting in prose that might not otherwise seem exciting. I think it's fun to bring that into poetry and to try and figure out how to talk about things that aren't, you know, talk about other texts, talk about, stuff like that.
And in your case, Craig, did the decision to turn to prose as a form, do you feel that's affected by writing critical prose?
Well, sort of. I mean, what I said before is really true. I really always did want to be a fiction writer, and I just think it's too hard. And I started writing poems as a teenager because it was just, I didn't have the attention span for it. So this really was like my compromise when I figured out that I could write these little two-page, one-page pieces. And certainly I think I practiced as a prose writer writing reviews for years before I started writing these things. So it was sort of practice.
Right. And how about you, Maureen? Your poem about the Russian novel makes one question whether even the subject matter of reviewing can leach into the poetry.
Yeah, I mean, I feel, you know, that most of our brains aren't divided into critical and creative components. I mean, one hears this all the time, you know, as if these were opposed faculties, reason and imagination, et cetera. And I always felt that my own interest in poetry as a reader was also profoundly governing the kinds of things I was inspired to do as a writer, but it also was inspiring responses in prose, and I began reviewing in part to communicate certain kinds of enthusiasms and also frustrations, and wanting to, in a way, make my own thinking visible to myself. I mean, I'm one of those people who really, you know, wrote out toward clearer positions I felt for myself, and also wanted to share them with others. So I also think that in terms of, I have a fairly eclectic interest in a lot of different kinds of poetry, and that can be a strength and it can be a weakness. But that also, I think, shows up in a kind of polemical eclecticism in my own, quote, creative writing, you know. So I think that, again, I do feel like I don't have a dissociated sensibility, and there's the critical pod and the creative pod. And so it's a complicated feedback loop. And a poem like the Russian novel poem, clearly there was Russian reading in the background. And what's really interesting, I mean, I feel it's an experience, you know, it's an experience like going to the movies. It's an experience, you know, there are many experiences we have coming over the transom. And for some of us, reading is, you know, just a profoundly intimate, galvanizing experience. And those of us for whom that is true tend to write reviews. So, but also those of us for whom that is true tend to be writers in various genres, too. So I definitely think there's a very, I'm sure for all of us, there's a very intimate relationship between these, you know, practices.
Jordan, is it that intimate for you?
I wanted to speak to something Craig said, which is when I was a junior in high school, Paul Muldoon came and spoke at our high school, which I think had a lot to do with another English teacher that we had there, who was a very attractive woman who had been at Stanford when Paul was at Stanford. And he came and spoke to us, and he said he got into poetry because they gave him extra credit and the poems were short. And he advised the English teachers that if they wanted to create poets, they could give extra credit. And one of our English teachers said, well, we already do that. And I said, And then I proceeded to heckle him about Parnell. I said, you can't really be an Irish poet. You have no Parnell in your poems. He said, I do. And then he read something, but it's a long story. But the fact that poetry is short, and the fact that poetry consists mainly of gravitating towards what you have strong completely not understandable feelings about, and that you have to talk about in these peculiar words that nobody wants to hear, that was very attractive for me. And the fact that criticism I have different feelings when I write poems. I'm feeling excited and attracted to something. When I'm writing criticism, I'm feeling terrified that somebody's going to point out that I'm an ignorant buffoon, and that everything that I think and understand about poetry is completely wrong. And not only do I not have the right set of jargon, but I don't have the right even set of eyeballs to look at a poem. And I, for some reason, enjoy that too.
So the overlap, I guess, is there's an overlap in perversities. I think it's completely perverse to be interested in poetry, and I think it's even more perverse to read a book of poems enough times to write something sensible about it, which you pretty much have to do to write a review. And whether or not reviewers do that is another conversation for another day. But I think the common preoccupation is just magnetic attraction and repulsion.
Great. Well, we've gotten to the perversity of writing poetry and criticism already, so I think we're humming right along here. Do any of you feel that you write critically for a specific audience? And again, I'm thinking of Ashbery's comment that the general interest publication is on the wane. Do you really have a reader in mind when you speak to that other?
Should we go back the other way this time?
Sure.
A remark that my old teacher liked to tell me was that one time Leonard Cohen had tried to get him to become a singer. And he said, "I can't do that. I can't sing." And Leonard Cohen said, "Look at me." But he also said, "Look, it's like this. You write the songs towards the 14-year-old girls and the 40-year-old women." And I thought that that remark said more about Leonard Cohen than really anything any critic could ever say. Now, what was the question again?
Do you write for a specific audience?
Well, so we write for the audience of the editors who assign us the pieces. And it's a conversation and a collaboration. And we understand generally what the readership of the publications that the editor works for, and it's like some kind of Saussurean diagram of you, editor, and audience, and like not a Venn diagram, but like a funnel. I write the same way no matter which editor is looking at it, but it always ends up slightly different wherever it goes. But I'm always thinking about, well, what would this look like in print this way? And it's kind of fun. Yeah. It's my nonsense answer.
I mean, but yeah, that's weird. You know, that notion of writing for the editor, sometimes I feel like the only audience that I can guarantee for a review that I write is the person who's assigned it to me. And so there is a way in which I feel like I'm talking to that person. And like, if I know what they look like, that either helps or scares the crap out of me. But then when I'm on the other side and I am editing for PW, I don't write. I've read a couple of them, but most of them I have other people write, and I think of the audience that I know is the readership, you know, and I think, well, okay, this is first going to be read by booksellers and librarians, and so I have to make sure that they get the information they need. But when I'm reviewing myself, I just think of that one person because I'm certain nobody else will read it.
I became aware of, I mean, I've written for different kinds of some more specialist journals where you can presume readers already have a pre-existing interest in poetry and an acquaintance with, you know, maybe some poets, maybe some debates or interesting trends. But I also wrote a lot, for example, for the Chicago Tribune. And there, one of the reasons I really liked that, and this may have been a fictional gambit, but I liked the opportunity to write for the idea of a common reader, somebody who had absolutely no a priori interest in poetry, but might be interested in hearing about a book that exists in the world, and this is what the poets these days are doing. And so I think Ashbery's probably not wrong in terms of his description of a sociology of, you know, periodicals and newspapers and readership now. But I also think that, you know, you see in a lot of British journals, like the LRB or the TLS, I mean, they're pitched at a very educated audience, but also at an audience that might not be versed in the specificities of quantum physics, but they will cover, you know, ongoing debates in quantum physics. And I sometimes feel that, you know, it's important to be able to sometimes occupy that position, as well as to write for much more specialist journals where you're not having to say, you know, welcome to the strange menagerie, you know, because we all, I mean, most adults have had an experience of being taught poetry, but maybe haven't read a poem since they were 18. And there's a lot of poetry phobia. I mean, I found that in graduate school. I mean, there was nothing that would stop a community of, you know, 20-something graduate students dead, cold in the water, than to kind of bring a poem, you know. And these were incredibly intellectually venturesome people, but there's some way that they're, that among, you know, general audiences, there's this sense of the horror and trauma and danger of contemporary poetry, and one can go on and on about that too. But so I'm really grateful, and I'm interested in, from a sociological perspective, in those people who do write for broader audiences when they have an opportunity. It's clear those opportunities have withered. But I also love the smaller magazines and journals, and I feel the level of discourse there is really high and goes to kind of warp speed very quickly.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I mean, I've also found like that once you start writing a lot about poetry, you begin to get called upon to write about it for broader audiences. I mean, and I've been writing for a bunch of newspapers in the last year, and really noticing the differences in the kinds of books I get assigned, and in the way that I, you know, again, not really being sure that anybody's going to read my review in the Cleveland Plain Dealer of Henri Cole, but thinking that I have to somehow pitch it at that person who won't know who he is and won't care, you know, and trying to think about, well, how do I make this sound like it's about something that they like, even though it's just about a miserable guy, you know, waiting around for the end.
So a miserable guy in Columbus, though. So there's a local
right, which is why.
And is there a temptation to dumb it down? To,
you know, people would always say that. They would assume that might be the case if you were writing for, say, a general audience newspaper. And I'm telling you, the Chicago Tribune published some of the most recondite kinds of pieces and allowed me to talk about, you know, really experimental poets. And I think, you know, the best editors at those places want things that are, you know, again, transmittable in a general language, but do not dumb stuff down. And I really think that's a really important, in a way, civic opportunity. And so I don't think that there's a necessary dumbing down in the general news. I think there can be an incredible crudeness and coarseness and a kind of trying to sell it to the reader. And I hate that kind of poetry, good and good for you, like your veggies thing. I sort of feel like if nobody reads it, well, nobody reads it. But you can't be, I'm very, at best, ambivalent about, you know, emissary for poetry in general. It's like, look, most art in any period sucks. Yeah. Right? I mean, that's just statistically the case, yeah. Right? So, I mean, I don't feel like I'm John the Baptist paving the way for the Jesuses, you know, and Jesusettes, you know, of contemporary poetry. So, at any rate, I'm sorry, you tapped into irritable. Yeah.
Well, and I think as many of us know or can simply intuit, even though the answer there is somewhat noble in the sense that this is our language, and we're going to respect it and forward it. Sadly, it's not the editorial staff of the newspaper who is governing the size of the book review section, the existence of the book review section. And it's a very worrisome time, a culture that, I mean, let alone won't talk about its poetry, but now they don't even want to talk about books of current events. This is a fearsome thing.
I mean, but it's weird, though, because there is, I mean, and this is maybe something you're going to get to, but on the internet there is more conversation about everything than there ever was. It's just less organized. And so the culture does really want to talk about things, just the people don't want to, I mean, advertisers don't want to monetize it.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, it's actually more organized but less advertised.
Well, let's stay on the, it's 2010, so we have to invoke the digital paradigm at some point and might as well do it now. What has changed, or how does that platform change reviewing? What does it open for poetry criticism? What does it shut down, for that matter?
I've been writing for a website for Fence Magazine for 8 years called constantcritic.com, and we've had a new editor in the past year, and we're actually publishing every week, which is a great improvement. I think one of the things about the publishing on the internet is that there's no real urgency. You can publish, you do your work in your PJs, so people do their work when they're asleep. And I think one of the lovely things about it is that there is a greater quantity. I think one of the generally disappointing things is that, well, to take an example, my wife got a what I thought was, you know, a fairly standard review where the obligatory negative remark was, there are several mentions of trees in this book, but she doesn't individuate the species of tree. And it would be a good thing in her next book to talk more about different kinds of trees. And then there was, the breadth and the depth, or I guess are the categories that we're looking at now. I think there's a broader discussion. I think the depth never really changes that much. I think there's always some that's fairly serious. I think one of the issues that the internet has not really remedied is how to get different conversations happening among different groups of people, how to get groups of people talking to each other. And I think it's been very effective at marketing to subgroups and niches, and I have counted on these subgroups and niches to keep me from dying of mental complete atrophy my day job for the last 10 years. But I think the interesting thing is when there's conflict and some kind of dialogue between people who have completely different points of view, and I haven't seen that. I've seen the internet really sort of reinforcing a tribal sense, and I don't think that's really going to change anytime.
That's true about the tribal thing. I was going to say something about, I've been writing for the last 6 months for a blog about ebooks. I mean, what I do for a day job is news reporting, business news. But so I've gotten really fascinated with comments feeds on articles and blogs, and really fascinated with Twitter and how these two things allow people to interact with whatever text you're sort of professionally publishing at them. If you look at the Poetry Foundation website, whatever one thinks of it, there are a lot of readers for it, and there are people comment, and it's interesting to see this kind of counter-reviewing happening against the reviewing. And then there's also the kind of the Amazon review, which is maybe not such a phenomenon now, but a few years ago I can think of a couple of books that got kind of hacked at on Amazon, and that was sort of strange. At the same time, it tends to be those columns of comments tend to have this kind of tribal feel to them.
Just wanted to call the audience's attention. It's out of print, but Kevin Killian published a remarkable book of Amazon reviews. You can't actually have it, but if you go onto Amazon and look for Kevin Killian, I think he's a top 50 reviewer. Also, if you look at Crystal Gavels, Ander Monson has written a fairly good review of Crystal Gavels. I think he says if you hold them up to the light, they'll blind you, and that's not a good thing. But the feed culture is fantastic, and I've seen it derided at literary panels. But I think it's actually the comment streams and Twitter are often as they hold their own against what they're commenting on.
Well, it is sort of a new aspect of the critical discourse that exists. I mean, it's not the same as reviewing, but it's something that's happened. And now, as a reviewer, you know that somebody might comment on what you've published, and you have to kind of deal with that.
I was actually curious what you thought about this as a publisher, and how, you know, the interface of your print and internet presence has shifted over recent years.
I find myself concurring a lot with at least halfway with what Craig and Jordan are saying. The thing is, it is fantastic to have a level of feedback and interactivity with ideas. That was the whole purpose from the beginning, I think, not a kind of gatekeeper mentality that I think criticism is often confused as being. But that said, some of these things are entertaining precisely because they degenerate into nonsense, and that certainly isn't the point of reviewing. The reasoned discourse is what we're seeking, the building up rather than the tearing down of an idea. So I find myself ambivalent of that level of interactivity. As a journal, we're very committed to both print and
internet presences. But we find that they aren't as similar as one might intuitively think, that they seem to have different purposes, different, I mean, obviously you have sort of unlimited word length on an internet, on a web page, the way you don't on a print page, and but there are 100 sort of little distinguishing marks that that come into play, and I just find that really interesting. But again, to use the tribal metaphor, it seems to me to be driving wedges between groups rather than bringing conversations together.
I just wanted to follow up and ask you: is your sense that the problem of self-interest, where poets are reviewing other poets, do you think that's gotten better, or do you think the inherent conflict of interest has changed at all since the advent of the internet, of having poets review other poets?
I think it's brought it. I think it's brought something that's certainly always existed to the surface. But the reality is that I think we sort of forget when we talk about the historical sense of it, that there are so many more people writing and publishing now than 30 years ago and 50 years before that and so forth. So just the sheer numbers make it a different proposition, in the same way that, if you walk into a restaurant and there are 10 people there, you're going to have a different experience if there are 100 people there. And the same is true if there's a conversation going on about your poetry chapbook. I think, people want to support their homies. That's the, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But I think we have to foreground it.
I actually find that people want to lacerate their homies, but but I've noticed that generationally speaking, writers who are under the age of 29 or so are much more immediately, readily, publicly supportive of each other for a very brief instant, right around publication. It's like the drop date. It's like the album has a drop date, the book has a drop date on the street, and they sell as many copies as they can within a couple of weeks of publication, and then you don't hear about the book. I just was following for a while the HTML Giant site, and I was just absolutely floored by how supportive and how briefly supportive the writers were for each other. It was like, and now it's your day. I was like, well, cool, but it's a book, and it has a life, and you carry that with you, and it's not just the other side of the story is that I'm now starting to read books as if they were comic books. I can read 3 to 5 books of poems in the various commutes that I do in a day, and if there's one that does something to me, I'll go back and read it a bunch more times. But I can only afford that because it's some percentage of these are coming in for free. I mean, if ideally I'd be consuming 3 or 4 books of poetry a day, and then stopping to read something to get my mind back for a couple months or something. But I don't know. I don't know.
One more question before. Well, maybe can we turn it to the audience? Oh, okay, good. Well, I forgot to ask our hosts if that was permissible. But one more question, sort of a tangent along the lines we're going here, is that poetry is often thought in a marginalizing way as an academic pursuit, not a community endeavor, something that requires study. To perform and to interpret. And obviously there is an industry of academic criticism. Maureen, you are the author of 2 books of romantic criticism, I believe. So do you find that these, has this relationship changed at all, the role of the more academic side of criticism and the more populist book reviewing?
It seems that... maybe one thing that does seem to be the case is that the lines are blurred now in a way that's, I don't know if it's better or worse, it's just interestingly different. And I think that this is related to the whole question of, say, academic humanities professors in the public sphere, and what Lionel Trilling meant at a certain moment, even what Harold Bloom meant at a certain moment. That's not, it's a different moment of cultural authority and cultural capital. And so you're not going to get exactly that kind of... there's a desire from the pronunciation on high, yet there's a much more active conversation in several, both tribal, but also kind of super-tribal communities. So, and in a way, it might be that we're going back, interestingly, to a kind of early 19th century formation in which, you know, most of the people who were writing for the first reviews, the Edinburgh Review and the Blackwoods, et cetera, they were not professors. They were men, mostly men, but a few women of letters. And I think there's an interesting way that might be, that whole thing is being revived. And there's all that gnashing of teeth about the death of the public intellectual. It's like, well, maybe, but maybe you just don't know what it looks like anymore. You know, so I actually feel like, I'm not a self-hating academic, you know, so I also feel like actually academics have their communities too, however, you know, screwy they are. And sometimes they have a kind of Venn diagram overlap with poetry communities too. And I think it's a kind of rigid polarity that people use as a shorthand because it's convenient for them. And I think it's anti-intellectual and I think it's anti-aesthetic. You know, not to say that you don't get a bunch of people who are super professorial about poetry. And sometimes that's appropriate given the object, and sometimes it's crazy. And I think there's an interesting, Steve Burt has a really interesting essay about a generational shift and this whole question of the content of the work of a lot of younger poets and what is it for people to write entire books generated around the affect around superheroes? And what happens if you have a 75-year-old critic who doesn't respond to that and wants his or her Persephone, right? And one way to kind of go at that is to have a contempt for popular culture. Another way is to over-reverence it. And I'm really interested in, I'm not interested in either position, you know, but I do think it's a very interesting transitional moment, and the different place of the academic critic and also the academic poet in that is a symptom of this shift.
I think there's no danger of an end to Persephone books.
It's true, unfortunately. Pomegranates forever.
I feel like I am coming at this from the other side, because I feel like they say, you know, you get an MFA and then you either go work in publishing or go teach, and I worked in publishing, and so I feel like my brain has always been trying to rescue poetry from, or just rescue books from the ways that my work with them touches the marketing departments of publishers, and so I think for me, maybe it's kind of the same. I'm always trying to pull it back to a kind of private pursuit of reading somewhere that I'm alone, where nobody can find me, and I wonder if academics have that same kind of anxiety of having to get their reading away from their need to publish papers and teach classes and present their findings.
I think I'm charged with wrapping things up here, and I just want to say by way of summation that we strongly believe at Rain Taxi that criticism is itself an art. And I think that really is true, certainly of our three poet critics here, but there are many, many writers in all disciplines who are weighing in on their art forms in provocative ways, and I think it's a fascinating time, and I think we're building a culture of reasoned response, and so I hope that we can continue to attract adherence to the position that that this is an art form and not an opposition, not the creative critical opposition is itself really false and not productive. At any rate, I've enjoyed this tremendously, and I want to thank Jordan, Craig, and Maureen, and all of you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you all. Please join us in a month for the next one. Thank you all.